Well, the subject of today's lecture is T.S. Eliot, and the title is Wasteland and Still Centre. English Victorian poetry, you might say, lasts lingeringly up to the First World War, when it's blown to smithereens somewhere around Passchendaele. By the 20s, poetry in Britain, situated in hell among mythological shades, has the whole of world culture for its subject matter, and is written in a syncopated babel of tongues by homeless and sometimes slightly psychotic, the American psychosis Hart Crane speaks of, cosmopolitans. I'm thinking mainly, of course, of Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot. And at this moment, specifically, Thomas Stearns Eliot. It appears likely, says Eliot in his essay, The Metaphysical Poets, one of his most important essays, 1921, that poets in our civilization, as it exists at present, must be difficult. Our civilization comprehends great variety and complexity, and the variety and complexity playing upon a refined sensibility must produce various and complex results. The poet must become more and more comprehensive, more elusive, more indirect, in order to force, to dislocate, if necessary, language into his meaning. The poet then must be able to amalgamate disparate experience. The ordinary man, says Eliot, falls in love or reads Spinoza, and these two experiences have nothing to do with each other or with the noise of the typewriter or the smell of cooking. In the mind of the poet, these experiences are always forming new wholes. The method then, the poetic method of Eliot, at least in the first stages, is kaleidoscopic. As to the situation in which this method seemed the only appropriate one, the only attractive one, Musil, the Austrian writer, saw it in these terms. He says, we're concerned no longer with the whole man, but with an unformed something floating about in a universal culture medium. In Britain, seeing this situation from a Marxist point of view, Christopher Codwell talked of death throes, agonies, demented swan songs. Well, we'll see later ourselves what global perspectives we'll come to, but before looking into this whole territory and following out its various movements, let me say at the outset that if Eliot's poetry is, I suppose, difficult, it's not difficult in the sense of, say, some kind of superior crossword puzzle. It's difficult, and I put the word in inverted commas because I don't find it particularly difficult. It's difficult because of its multicultural references, its elliptic phrasing, its rapid associations and transitions, as in Ezra Pound, and its multi-level imagery. But it also, for those very reasons, has a lot of fascination and affords a great deal of immediate satisfaction. Let us go then, you and I, when the evening is spread out against the sky like a patient etherized upon a table. Let us go through certain half-deserted streets, the muttering retreats of restless nights and one-night cheap hotels and sawdust restaurants with oyster shells. Streets that follow like a tedious argument of insidious intent to lead you to an overwhelming question. Oh, do not ask, what is it? Let us go and make our visit. In the room, the women come and go, talking of Michelangelo. The yellow fog that rubs its back upon the window panes, the yellow smoke that rubs its muzzle on the window panes, licked its tongue into the corners of the evening, lingered upon the pools that stand in drains, let fall upon its back the soot that falls from chimneys, slipped by the terrace, made a sudden leap on seeing that it was a soft October night, curled once about the house and fell asleep. And indeed, there will be time for the yellow smoke that slides along the street, rubbing its back upon the window panes. There will be time to prepare a face to meet the faces that you meet. There will be time to murder and create, and time for all the works and days of hands that lift and drop a question on your plate. Time for you and time for me, and time yet for 100 indecisions and for 100 visions and revisions before the taking of a toast and tea. The eye of this poem is, at least in part, T.S. Eliot. T.S. Eliot was born 1888 in St. Louis, Missouri, Saint-Louis, the old French capital of Louisiana. His parents on both sides, Eliots and Sterns, were of old English ancestry and solid New England stock. In religion, they're Presbyterian, that's to say a pretty strong Protestant line, and Unitarian. Unitarianism, to define it in a few words, is the attempt to link Plato to the Bible. His grandfather founded the first Unitarian church in St. Louis, and he settled there in 1834. So you have T.S. Eliot moving between Missouri, the big river, the Mississippi, Missouri, and Massachusetts, the seacoast of Massachusetts. And these landscapes are going to come back later on. 1906, 1910, he's studying at Harvard, which is, for Eliot, a kind of extension of home, because one of his ancestors had been president of that university. Eliot, however, finds the atmosphere both Puritan and provincial. And the U.S. in general is extremely critical about it from the beginning, saying that it is a secondary zone. However, at Harvard, one of his teachers greatly inspired him. This man was Irving Babbitt, specifically with one book, Masters of Modern French Criticism. So he's reading modern French poets and critics, and he's also reading Dante. 1910, 1911, as soon as he can, he moves to Europe and he goes to the Sorbonne and to Munich. In Paris, he listens to Bergson's lectures at the Collège de France, Bergson speaking on time, and he didn't always disagree. He didn't always agree with Bergson, but time is always a preoccupation in Eliot's poetry, in his mind. 1911, he went back to America with the bones of a doctorate thesis in philosophy, and the title of the thesis was Meinungsgestandstheorie, considered in relation to Bradley's theory of knowledge. At this time, he also started learning Sanskrit and Pali. 1914, he went back to Germany. After Munich, he went to Marburg, there to study Husserl. But this was the beginning of the war, so he hastened over to Britain, where he went to Merton College, Oxford, and plunged back into Aristotle. 1915, 1916, he's teaching at schools in England to make a living. He's teaching a bewildering medley of subjects, French, mathematics, history, geography, drawing, and swimming. 1915, he marries. 1917, his first book comes out, Prufrock and Other Observations. We'll come back to it later. Largely helped on by Ezra Pound. And he becomes one of the editors of the review The Egoist. 1917-1925, he's working as clerk in Lloyd's Bank, London. So he ends his living as a bank clerk. 1920, his first essays appear under the title The Sacred Wood. And his essays were going to have as much influence as his poetry. 1922, The Wasteland, dedicated to Ezra Pound. 1922 to 1939, he's editor of the review, very influential review, The Criterion. 1925, another poem book, The Hollow Men. 1928, he becomes a British citizen and also a member of the Anglican Church. Two moves in the same direction, a British citizen and a member of the Anglican Church. From 1925 to 1965, he's co-director of the publishing house Faber and Faber. So with his editorship of certain influential magazines and his position as director at Faber and Faber's, it's obvious enough that during those years, Eliot had an influential position. In fact, was probably, almost certainly, the most influential man of letters in the English-speaking world. 1932, he went back to the States, and we'll come to that later, where he occupied for a year the Charles Eliot Norton Chair of Poetry at Harvard. 1936, another book of essays, essays, ancient and modern, and in that year his collected poems appear. 1943, a very, very beautiful poem book, the one I'm most attached to, Four Quartets. 1943, Four Quartets. 1947, Nobel Prize for Literature. 1948, an influential essay, Notes Towards a Definition of Culture. 1957, a second marriage. And 1965, I'm jumping again over the years, he dies in London. The poem I quoted from a few minutes ago, Let Us Go Then, You and I, is entitled The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock. And it's taken from the book Prufrock and Other Observations. The poem was written between Paris and Munich in 1911. Before going any further into Eliot's territory, let's look at that name, Prufrock. Slightly ridiculous, huh? Prufrock. Sounding very much, by the way, like J. Alfred Prufrock, in pound you have J. Selwyn Moberly. Huh? The similarity is obvious. Let's come back to Prufrock, a mixture of prudery and frock. Huh? In other words, there's a great deal of self-irony in the presentation of this figure. And this self-irony comes straight to Eliot from a French poet called Jules Laforgue. In particular, from his Complainte, Complainte sur certains ennuis, Complainte de la lune en province, which ends with these words, Et la lune a bonne vieille du coton dans les oreilles. It's the kind of image that you have a patient etherized upon a table. And it's the same kind of thing. The influence of Baudelaire, by the way, is also there in the patient etherized upon a table. Baudelaire, who described the world in terms of a hospital. Let's think of another Jules Laforgue poem, L'hiver qui vient, which speaks of blocus sentimental. Prufrock knows a blocus sentimental, a sentimental blockage. Same poem, Ah, nuées accumulées, des côtes de la Manche, vous nous avez gâté notre dernier dimanche. A kind of easy-going melancholy. On the same poem, L'hiver qui vient, un soleil blanc comme un crachat d'estaminé. Comme un crachat d'estaminé. Un soleil blanc comme un crachat d'estaminé. Again, the same kind of image as a patient etherized upon a table. And the poem ends with lampe, estampe, thé, petit four, which is exactly your before the taking of a toast and tea. Exactly the same. The atmosphere of Laforgue, with its self-irony, its spleen kilométrique, I'm quoting L'hiver qui vient, and its un couchant des cosmogonies, is omnipresent in the early Eliot, and later on also. Another French influence, more vigorous, more biting and scathing in tone, is the French poet, Breton poet, Tristan Corbière. Tristan Corbière, who describes himself in one of his poems, Le Poète Contumace, in the following terms, faisant un à peu près d'artiste, un philosophe d'à peu près, râleur de soleil de frais, en dehors de l'humaine piste. And in his epitaphe pour Tristan Joachim Édouard Corbière, philosophe, he describes himself in these terms, épave mornée, mélange adultère de tout, de la fortune et pas le sou, de l'énergie et pas de force. This leads directly to Eliot's poem entitled Mélange adultère de tout. He takes the very line from Tristan Corbière. Mélange adultère de tout. En Amérique, professeur. En Angleterre, journaliste. C'est à grands pas et en sueur que vous suivrez à peine ma piste. En Yorkshire, conférencier. À Londres, un peu banquier. Vous me payerez bien la tête. C'est à Paris que je me coiffe, casque noir de je m'en foutiste. En Allemagne, philosophe, surexcité par Hohenheben, au grand air de Bergsteigleben. J'erre toujours de ci, de là, à travers à divers coups de tralala, de Damas jusqu'à Omaha. J'ai célébré mon jour de fête dans une oasis d'Afrique, vêtue d'une peau de girafe. On montrera mon cénotaphe aux côtes brûlantes de Mozambique. Well, this poem, written in French, as you realize, isn't the best thing that T.S. Eliot ever wrote, I don't think. But he did include it in his collected poems, 1909, 1935, so I don't feel too guilty quoting it. Another poem with a powerful influence coming from Tristan Corbière is the Cantique Spirituel, and a lot of Eliot's poems later are spiritual exercises. Cantique Spirituel, entitled La Rhapsode Foraine et le Pardon de Sainte-Anne. And it sounds beautifully like this. Bénite à l'infertile plage où, comme la mer, tout est nu. Sainte est la chapelle sauvage de Sainte-Anne de la Palue. A poem such as this leads to Eliot's own rhapsodies, notably Rhapsody on a Windy Night, which begins like this, 12 o'clock. Along the reaches of the street, held in a lunar synthesis, whispering lunar incantations. Dissolve the floors of memory and all its clear relations, its divisions and precisions. Every street lamp that I pass beats like a fatalistic drum, and through the spaces of the dark, midnight shakes the memory as a madman shakes a dead geranium. But it also led much further than that, I think. In that poem, Eliot must have seen, in the Tristan Corbière poem on Sainte-Anne de la Palue, Eliot, I think, must have seen the New England coast, as it's going to come across later in the poem, The Dry Salvages, which we'll come to. Even Sainte-Anne must, I think, have evoked in his mind and his memory Cape Ann on the coast of Massachusetts. Now, if Eliot went to these French sources, Jules Laforgue, Tristan Corbière, Charles Baudelaire, and others, saying in his essay on Yeats, The Poetry of Yeats, 1940, the kind of poetry that I needed to teach me the use of my own voice did not exist in English at all. It was only to be found in French. If he made this statement, and if he made this move to France, to French poetry, it was because he felt English poetry was incomplete. It is a pity, he says in his essay, The Metaphysical Poets, that English poetry has remained so incomplete. Now, what is this incompleteness of English poetry, and how did it come in? For Eliot, it came in the 17th century. It came from a dissociation of sensibility, from which, he says, we have never recovered, meaning English language poetry. If you like, thinking went one way, and sensitivity went another. And there was this dissociation between thinking and sensitivity. Poetry becoming more and more either heavily reflexive on the philosophical side, or sentimental, gushingly sentimental, on the feeling side. There was a dissociation. Reflection tending to artificiality, and emotion tending to sentimentality. And this dichotomy had its defenders on both sides, those who object to the artificiality, for example, of reflective poets like Milton or Dryden, will tell people to look into their hearts and write. But to look into your heart, said Eliot, isn't looking deep enough. You must look also into the cerebral cortex, the nervous system, and the digestive tracts. Now, it was this larger, more comprehensive grasp of things that Eliot saw in the French poets and in French poetry, just as he saw it later, after further explorations, in John Donne and in certain other English language poets, but pre this dissociation of the 17th century. Laforgue and Corbière, in Eliot's mind, are nearer to the school of Donne than any modern English poet. So he's not dividing in any simplistic way French poetry and English poetry. He's working out a new territory with certain French poets and certain English poets coming into it. With these poets, John Donne, for example, Laforgue and Corbière in France, with these he was trying to get at a reunification of sensibility, a reunification of the mind, towards a kind of emotive thinking, if you like, or thinking emotion. And he says this beautifully about John Donne. Donne felt his thought as immediately as the odor of a rose. Dawn felt his thought, as immediately as the odor of a rose. A kind of idea sensation, you know, a sensation idea. It was Dawn and company are usually called in the history of English literature the metaphysical poets. And it was Dr. Johnson, the famous Dr. Johnson, who invented the phrase. I don't think it's a good phrase, I'll say why later. But Dr. Johnson, describing these people as the metaphysical poets, said disapprovingly, because he wanted another kind of poetry, that the most heterogeneous ideas are yoked by violence together. The most heterogeneous ideas are yoked by violence together. This is exactly what Eliot will do. And there was in these poets a type of image which normally is called the metaphysical image. And this is the elaboration of a figure of speech to its furthest possible stages, the furthest possible stage to which ingenuity can carry it. Dawn, for example, describes lovers as a pair of compasses. He telescopes images and he uses multiple associations. But he can also achieve, and you must never forget this when you're concerned with these metaphysical poets, if they have on the one hand elaborate concetti, on the other hand you can have an absolute simplicity, a marvelously pure, simple, clean, clear simplicity. For example, John Donne is capable of saying this, a bracelet of bright hair about the bone. A bracelet of bright hair about the bone. In other words, you can achieve what I like to call a kind of lightning stroke in the mind. As I said, I don't like this word metaphysical because they're not concerned necessarily with metaphysics. I like to call it intellectual. Intellectual in the strong original sense of the word. Most intellectuals, as the word is used in a banal context, not being, in my sense of the word, intellectual at all. They are ratiocinative, ruminative, or reflective. Well, it was this emotive intellectuality, this intellectual emotion, this idea sensation that Eliot found in France very, very early on, and that he was to continue to find in other French writers. He was interested very much, for example, in Jacques Maritain, especially when he converted to Anglo-Catholicism, Jacques Maritain the Thomist, with his Réflexions sur l'intelligence. And he was interested, very much so, in another French poet, Saint-Jean de Perse, translating the Anabase. He's after a unity of sensibility. Let's look at the title of that early book, Prufrock and Other Observations. He doesn't say other poems. You know? He wants rid of the normal connotations of the word poem. He's after observations. But the question is how to develop observations into the unity of a state of mind. How do you go from disparate observations into the unity of a state of mind? That, for Eliot, is the question. The French influence was strong, so was the German, just as strong. The French mind meant for Eliot intelligence and sensibility. Germany meant largely Kulturkritik, culture criticism. And it was this culture criticism that led directly to the poem, The Wasteland, from which I'll now read an extract. April is the coolest month. Breeding lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory and desire, stirring dull roots with spring rain. Winter kept us warm, covering earth in forgetful snow, feeding a little life with dried tubers. Summer surprises coming over the Starnberger See with a shower of rain. We stopped in the colonnade and went on in sunlight into the Hofgarten and drank coffee and talked for an hour. Mit gar keine Russen stand aus Litauen echt Deutsch. And when we were children staying at the Archduke's, my cousins, He took him out on the sled, and I was frightened. He said, Marie, Marie, hold on tight. And down we went. In the mountains, there you feel free. I read much of the night and go south in the winter. What are the roots that clutch? What branches grow out of this stony rubbish? Son of man, you cannot say or guess, for you know only a heap of broken images where the sun beats, and the dead tree gives no shelter, the cricket no relief, and the dry stone no sound of water. Only there is shadow under this red rock. Come in under the shadow of this red rock. And I will show you something different from either, your shadow at morning striding behind you, or your shadow at evening rising to meet you. I will show you fear in a handful of dust. Frisch weht der Wind der Heimat zu, mein irisch Kind, wo weilest du? You gave me hyacinth first a year ago, they called me the hyacinth girl. Yet when we came back late from the hyacinth garden, your arms full and your hair wet, I could not speak and my eyes failed. I was neither living nor dead and I knew nothing. Looking into the heart of light, the silence, öd und leer das Meer. Madame the Sostress, famous clairvoyante, had a bad cold, nevertheless, is known to be the wisest woman in Europe, with a wicked pack of cards. Here, she'd see, is your card, the drowned Phoenician satyr. Those are pearls that his eyes look. Here is Belladonna, the lady of the rocks, the lady of situations. Here is the man with three staves, and here the wheel, and here is the one-eyed merchant. And this card, which is blank, is something he carries on his back, which I am forbidden to see. I do not find the hanged man. Fear death by water. I see crowds of people walking round in a ring. Thank you. If you see dear Mrs. Equitone, tell her I bring the horoscope myself. One must be so careful these days. Unreal city. Under the brown fog of a winter dawn, a crowd flowed over London Bridge, so many. I had not thought death had undone so many. Sighs, short and infrequent, were exhaled, and each man fixed his eyes before his feet, flowed up the hill and down King William Street, to where St. Mary Woolnoth kept the hours with a dead sound on the final stroke of nine. There I saw one I knew and stopped him, crying, Stetson! You who were there with me in the ships at Mealy, that corpse you planted last year in your garden, has it begun to sprout? Will it bloom this year? Or has a sudden frost disturbed its bed? Oh, keep the dog far hence that's friend to men, or with his nails he'll dig it up again. You, hypocrite lecteur, mon semblable, mon frère. The French mark is still there, especially in that last line, Baudelaire, straight from Baudelaire. And Baudelaire is in this poem, the Baudelaire of fourmillante cité, cité pleine de rêves, où le spectre en plein jour accroche le passant. Baudelaire also, with his description of the town of Paris in particular, hôpital, lupanar, purgatoire, enfer, bagne, un désert rocailleux troublé par des cris aigres. But even more present is Spengler's Decline of the West, or Hesse's Blick ins Chaos, quoted in German in the Notes of the Wasteland. Schon ist halb Europa, schon ist zumindest der halbe Osten Europas auf dem Wege zum Chaos, fährt betrunken im heiligen Wahn am Abgrund entlang und senkt dazu, senkt betrunken und hymnisch, wie Dmitri Karamazow sang. Über diese Lieder lacht der Bürger beleidigt, der Heilige und sehr hört sie mit Tränen. Half of Europe on the way to chaos, says Hermann Hesse, traveling drunk alongside an abyss, singing its head off. The bourgeois, offended, laughs. The holy man and the visionary, says Hesse, hears these songs with tears. Eliot's culture criticism comes across in his, mainly, in his Notes Towards the Definition of Culture, 1948. And he says this, and it, stemming directly from Spengler, The Decline of the West, Der Untergang des Abendlands, we can assert with some confidence that our period is one of decline, that the standards of culture are lower than they were 50 years ago, and that the evidence of this decline are visible in every department of human activity. I see no reason why the decay of culture should not proceed much further, and why we may not even anticipate a period of some duration of which it is possible to say that will have no culture. Then culture will have to grow again from the soil. And when I say it must grow again from the soil, I do not mean that it will be brought into existence by any activity of political demagogues. The question is whether there are any permanent conditions in the absence of which no higher culture can be expected. Well, we'll look later at Eliot's solutions to the problem, his way out of the situation. But to remain for a moment with the wasteland is not solution, but impression, description, observation, perambulation. All kinds of wanderers move through this poem. In particular, a Phoenician sailor, a sailor from Tyre. And the main observer is Tiresias, Tyre, Tiresias, an old, old man. The poem itself has two main sources, apart from the ones I've already mentioned, but two books had a direct influence on it. One was Jesse Weston's From Ritual to Romance, which is a study of the Grail legend, as put forward in the Middle Ages, going back, ultimately, to the Celtic underworld quest for the water of life that will revive the dead. Let's say that Eliot is moving from Corbière further back into La Matière de Bretagne, the matter of Brittany. Another book which was a direct influence on this poem was Fraser's The Golden Bough, this anthropological study, especially the two volumes concerning Adonis, Attis, and Osiris, and in particular, vegetation ceremonies. In other words, Eliot is using, modernizing, if you like, myth, much in the same way as James Joyce did in Ulysses, using ancient materials, old materials, in a highly modern context. Other materials come into the poem, heterogeneous materials. Dante comes in, Buddha comes in, Wagner comes in, Webster, St. Augustine, and the tarot. I'm not familiar with the exact constitution of the tarot pack of cards, he says, for which I have obviously departed to suit my own convenience. So he's using all these materials, but in his own way. So in a sense, it's wrong methodology. It's not really understanding the point to really go back into the tarot pack and try and study the tarot or study whatever. He's using them in his own way in the context of the poem. The result is a welter of images, a demented discourse, a kind of, and this is outside cultural chronology, but I'd like to call it a kind of rock apocalypse. After you reach the age of 25, says Eliot, if you wish to continue writing poetry, then you must have a sense of history. You must have a sense of cultural history. You must be able to see your situation in depth. You must have some kind of scope, some kind of intellectual scope, and you must have some kind of historical perspective. You must be engaged, in other words, in something other, something vaster than simply yourself and your own personal poetry. And this comes across in the book, in the essay rather, Tradition and the Individual Talent. He says you must know the whole of European literature since Homer. And writing of somebody as important, as significant as William Blake, T.S. Eliot is not afraid to say, and he was sticking his neck out, that Blake lacked a traditional framework of ideas naturalized in his mind. And Blake was only, and I quote T.S. Eliot, Blake was only a poet of genius. The idea is, and I think Eliot is right, the idea is to go beyond the self, go beyond the personal, not necessarily, in my opinion, into the tradition and into the type of traditional thought that Eliot promulgated, but into a vaster, I won't even say scheme of things, but space of things. However, let's come back to Eliot. Tradition and individual talent. Poetry is not a turning loose of emotion, but an escape from emotion. He really was going against the grain of the poeticals. Poetry is not a turning loose of emotion, but an escape from emotion. It is not the expression of personality, but an escape from personality. But of course, only those who have personality and emotions know what it means to want to escape from those things. And he speaks in the same essay of significant emotion. Emotion which has its life in the poem and not in the history of the poet. One way of getting out beyond the person, getting into a larger space, was what Eliot called, and the word was going to have a long and large fortune, causing much ink to be spilt. One way was what he called the objective correlative. The objective correlative. To express emotion articulately, the only way for Eliot was to find a series of objects or situations or a chain of events which would lead to that emotion. You don't try and express the emotion immediately, personally. You try and move into a space with objects, movements, events, which will lead to that emotion. This is the objective correlative. And if I, as you said, when I said the word, it's because, as I say, a lot of ink has been spilled over it, whereas I think it's perfectly clear, perfectly simple, and perfectly practicable. In Religion and Literature, 1935, he says this, again sticking his neck out, literary criticism should be completed by criticism from a definite ethical and theological standpoint. Ethical standpoint I can probably go with, theological standpoint, we'll speak about it later. 1928, he comes out with his famous phrase, 1928, remember the year when he becomes a British citizen and also a member of the Anglican Church. I am, he says, classicist in literature, royalist in politics, and Anglo-Catholic in religion. Classicist in literature, royalist in politics, and Anglo-Catholic in religion. In an essay, Religion and Literature, he says that the whole of modern literature is corrupted by what I call secularism. It is simply unaware of the primary of the supernatural over the natural life. And he says that the modern world is trying to work out a non-Christian mentality, but it will fail. He, being out with a Christian mentality and with a situation, situating himself deeply in his notions of Christian tradition and Christian method, is out to redeem the time, keep the faith in the dark ages, renew or reconstruct civilization, and save the world from suicide. He says this, the unitary community, and this I take, although as I say, I can't take his Anglo-Catholicism nor his Christian tradition, but when he says this, I think he's right. The unitary community, whatever it may be, should be religious social. Well, we might use other words than religion, but let's take it as a start. The unitary community should be religious social, no longer wholly realized except in very primitive tribes indeed. Except in very primitive tribes, where you have this unity of the social and a larger scheme of things, whether you call it mythology, religion, cosmology, and I would like to call it simply cosmology, right? To avoid words with too much fat about them, too much sickly fat. And he goes on to speak of primitive tribes. Without sentimentalizing the life of the savage, we might practice the humility to observe in some of the societies upon which we look down on as primitive or backward, the operation of a social, religious, artistic complex. Now, we might choose other words, but the thing is there. A social, religious, artistic complex which we should emulate upon a higher plane. This is Eliot speaking. The struggle to recover the sense of relation to nature and to God, the recognition that even the most primitive feelings should be part of our heritage, seem to me to be the explanation and justification of the life of D.H. Lawrence and the excuse for his aberrations. But we need not only to learn how to look at the world with the eyes of a Mexican Indian, and I hardly think that Lawrence succeeded, we certainly cannot afford to stop there. We need to know how to see the world as the Christian fathers saw it. And the purpose of reascending to origins is that we should be able to return with greater spiritual knowledge to our own situation. This is 1939, the idea of a Christian society. And his idea of a Christian society was by no means something easy, by no means simply a kind of social habit with some morality attached. He says this in another essay, Thoughts After Lambeth, 1931, "There is no good in making Christianity easy and pleasant. Youth, or the better part of it, is more likely to come to a difficult religion than to an easy one. Difficult both to the disorderly mind and to the unruly passions." Now let's just look at one poem which is concerned with Eliot's Christianity before moving on to something else. This poem is the Journey of the Magi. A cold coming we had of it, just the worst time of the year for a journey on such a long journey. The ways deep and the weather sharp, the very dead of winter, and a camel's galled, sore-footed refractory, lying down in the melting snow. There were times we regretted the summer palaces and slopes, the terraces and the silken girls bringing sherbet. Then the camel men cursing and grumbling and running away and wanting their liquor and women, and the night fires going out and the lack of shelters, and the cities hostile and the town unfriendly, and the villages dirty and charging high prices. A hard time we had of it. At the end, we preferred to travel all night, sleeping in statues, with the voices singing in our ears, saying that this was all folly. Then at dawn, we came down to a temperate valley, wet below the snow line, smelling of vegetation, with a running stream and a watermill beating the darkness in three trees on the low sky, and an old white horse galloped away in the meadow. Then we came to a tavern with vine leaves over the lintel, six hands at an open door dicing for pieces of silver and feet kicking the empty wineskins. But there was no information, and so we continued and arrived at evening, not a moment too soon, finding the place. It was, you may say, satisfactory. All this was a long time ago, I remember, and I would do it again, but set down this. Were we led all that way for birth or death? There was a birth, certainly, we had evidence and no doubt. I have seen birth and death, but had thought they were different. This birth was hard and bitter agony for us, like death our death. We returned to our places, these kingdoms, but no longer at ease there in the old dispensation, with an alien people clutching their gods. I should be glad of another death. One doesn't have, I think, to share Eliot's Christian thesis, and I've made it obvious that I don't, to have pleasure and profit from his Christian poems, except maybe when they're all too preachy. And one certainly doesn't have to take up his standpoint to move with a sense of deep affinity in these particularly beautiful poems, in my opinion, the four quartets. Perhaps because in these poems, probably his finest, Eliot, which is consistent with his theory, moves beyond Eliot. There, in these poems, tradition and structure seem to me to give way to space and movement. And if the first poems represented discontinuity and a wasteland simultaneity, here you have a kind of eternity, a white light moving and unmoving. These poems are concerned with four places, four quartets, four places. Burnt Norton in Gloucestershire, England, East Coker in Somerset, an ancestral place for T.S. Eliot, one of his ancestors came from there before moving to Boston. The Dry Salvages, which is just off the coast of Massachusetts, three rocks off the coast, and Little Gidding, again in England, near Cambridge, where there was a religious community, or had been a religious community, that of Nicholas Ferrer. Now, these are particular places. And in After Strange Gods, still pursuing his cultural theme, Eliot says that we have to discover what is the best life for us, not as a political abstraction, but as a particular people in a particular place. Not only are they particular places, but they are parishes. I am not presenting any idyllic picture of the rural parish, either present or past, in taking as a norm the idea of a small and mostly self-contained group attached to the soil and having its interests centered in a particular place with a kind of unity which may be designed but which also has to grow through generations. So a particular place, even a parish, but what is particular also in these poems is the presence of nature. Eliot's Christianity unites the supernatural with the natural as against the mechanical and abstract. And he says, a wrong attitude towards nature implies somewhere a wrong attitude towards God in his vocabulary. So he's against the values of a mechanized, commercialized, urbanized way of life. It would be as well for us to face the permanent conditions upon which God allows us to live upon this planet. Three out of the four places are English, but one is American, the Dry Salvages. A Franco-American term, by the way, the Dry Salvages in American was originally les Trois Sauvages, three rocks off the Massachusetts coast. And despite his later allegiances, it seems to me that Eliot still remains, to a great extent, an American poet. Eliot made a return trip to the States in 1932, and he says this concerning New England, which had been his locality. The local feelings were stirred very sadly by my first view of New England on arriving from Montreal and journeying all one day through the beautiful, desolate country of Vermont. Those hills had once, I suppose, been covered with primeval forest. The forest was raised to make sheep pastures for the English settlers. Now the sheep are gone, and most of the descendants of the settlers. And a new forest appeared, blazing with the melancholy glory of October maple and beech and birch scattered among the evergreens. And after this procession of scarlet and gold and purple wilderness, you descend to the sordor of the half-dead mill towns of southern New Hampshire and Massachusetts. It is not necessarily those lands which are the most fertile or most favored in climate that seem to me the happiest, but those in which a long struggle of adaptation between man and his environment has brought out the best qualities of both, in which the landscape has been molded by numerous generations of one race, and in which the landscape in turn has modified the race to its own character. And those New England mountains seem to me to give evidence of a human success so meager and transitory as to be more desperate than the desert. So, you still have in T.S. Eliot a critique of the U.S. as strong as ever, but I think this trip did waken American memories in his mind, and I think that it's these memories that led to the poem, The Dry Salvages. I do not know much about gods, but I think that the river is a strong brown god. This is Mississippi. I do not know much about gods, but I think that the river is a strong brown god, sullen, untamed, and intractable, patient to some degree at first recognized as a frontier, useful, untrustworthy as a conveyor of commerce. Then only a problem confronting the builder of bridges. The problem once solved, the brown god is almost forgotten by the dwellers in cities, ever, however, implacable, keeping his seasons and rages, destroyer, reminder of what men choose to forget. Unhonored, unpropitiated by worshippers of the machine, but waiting, watching, and waiting. His rhythm was present in the nursery bedroom, in the rank elanthus of the April dooryard, and the smell of grapes on the autumn table, and evening circle in the winter gaslight. The river is within us, the sea is all about us. The sea is the land's edge also, the granite into which it reaches, the beaches where it tosses, its hints of earlier and other creation, the starfish, the horseshoe crab, the whale's backbone, the pools where it offers to our curiosity, the more delicate algae and the sea anemone. It tosses up our losses, the torn seine, the shattered lobster pot, the broken oar, and the gear of foreign dead men. The sea has many voices, many gods and many voices. The salt is on the briar rose, the fog is in the fir trees. The sea howl and the sea yelp are different voices, often together heard. The whine and the rigging, the menace and caress of wave that breaks in water, the distant rote and the granite teeth, and the wailing warning from the approaching headland are all sea voices, and the heaving groaner rounded homewards, and the seagull. And under the oppression of the silent fog, the tolling bell measures time, not our time, rung by the unhurried groundswell, a time older than the time of chronometers, older than time counted by anxious, worried women lying awake, calculating the future, trying to unweave, unwind, unravel, and piece together the past and the future, between midnight and dawn, when the past is all deception, the future futureless, before the morning watch, when time stops and time is never ending, and the groundswell that is and was from the beginning clangs the bell. I reserved for the end of this lecture and these readings a poem entitled Marina, because it's based, this poem, on a questioning and a questing rather than on a structure of belief. Its epigraph says this: Quis hic locus, quae regio, quae mundi plaga? What is this place, this region, this beach of the world? The question Eliot's work leaves us with is how to find ways out of the wasteland. Eliot answered in terms of religious culture. Here, it seems to me, we have something else. Let me just read this poem, Marina. What seas, what shores, what grey rocks and what islands, what water lapping the bow, and scent of pine and the wood thrush singing through the fog, what images return, O my daughter? Those who sharpen the teeth of the dog, meaning death. Those who glitter with the glory of the hummingbird, meaning death. Those who sit in the sty of contentment, meaning death. Those who suffer the ecstasy of the animals, meaning death, are become unsubstantial, reduced by a wind, a breath of pine in the wood song fog, by this grace dissolved in place. What is this face less clear and clearer, the pulse in the arm less strong and stronger, given a lent, more distant than stars and nearer than the eye? Whispers and small laughter between leaves and hurrying feet under sleep, where all the waters meet. Bows spread cracked with ice and paint cracked with heat. I made this, I have forgotten and remember. The rigging weak and the canvas rotten between one June and another September. Made this unknowing, half conscious, unknown, my own. The garboard straight leaks, the seams need caulking. This form, this face, this life. Living to live in a world of time beyond me. Let me resign my life for this life, my speech for that unspoken, the awakened lips parted, the hope, the new ships. What seas, what shores, what granite islands towards my timbers, and wood thrush calling through the fog, my daughter. Just that one phrase I like to end on, grace dissolved in place. What I think we're finally concerned with is a rediscovery of place, a rediscovery of the earth, and a rewording of the world.